Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. This week, episode 311, The Battle of the Saints. Following the Franco-American victory at Yorktown in October of 1781, General Washington had pleaded with Admiral de Grasse to make use of the French naval fleet for a few other actions. Washington believed that even a few weeks at Charleston, South Carolina, would allow Nathanael Greene's Southern Army to take that town. The French commander, however, would not budge. He'd already spent longer than he planned in Virginia. The only reason he'd removed his fleet from the West Indies in the first place was to avoid peak hurricane season. His focus was on protecting French islands in the West Indies and capturing some British ones. North America was just a sideshow. Almost as soon as he could, de Grasse sailed his fleet away from Virginia and back to the West Indies. By November 26th, his fleet was back at Martinique. The same day the French fleet arrived at Martinique, another French squadron was capturing St. Eustatius. The British had captured the tiny Dutch island colony only a few months earlier. A fleet under Admiral George Rodney had captured the island in January of 1781, before the Dutch governor there was even aware that the Dutch Republic was at war with Britain. The Dutch had only about 60 militia on the 8-square-mile island and could offer no resistance. Admiral Rodney was particularly pleased to take control of St. Eustatius, mostly because it offered him a great payday. Rodney had racked up massive debt before the war. He even had to flee Britain and go to France to avoid creditors. When the revolution began, he had to borrow money from a French officer to return to England. As the commander of the fleet, Rodney would be entitled to a pretty large share of any booty his fleet captured. After the Dutch surrendered the island, Rodney and his men would spend the next few months fleecing the population. Of particular interest to Rodney was the small community of Jewish merchants on the island. Rodney had the Jewish population move to St. Kitts while he pillaged their property, even cutting open their clothing and digging up their cemetery in search of hidden money. And he didn't stop there. Anything of value on the island was subject to seizure. Now, much of the property actually belonged to British merchants and should not have been seized. Rodney did not seem very concerned and confiscated everything. Rodney kept the Dutch flag flying over the island, hoping to lure more merchant vessels into port where he could capture and confiscate them. As I said, Rodney remained at St. Eustatius with his fleet for about 4 months, even missing another major naval battle in the region, which I'll get to in just a minute, due to his obsession with plundering wealth on the island. When the fleet finally left, the British Army left just 2 regiments to hold the island. The commander, Lieutenant Colonel James Cockburn, was not expecting another attack and did not seem to worry much about his defenses. On the night of November 26th, 1781, an invasion force of 1,500 French soldiers under the command of the Marquis de Boulay landed on St. Eustatius. The British garrison did not even notice. The following morning, Colonel Cockburn went out for his morning ride. The French soldiers simply captured him and took him prisoner. When the French attackers approached the fort, they found most of the garrison outside its walls on morning drill. When the surprised British garrison saw the approaching enemy, they rushed back into the fort. The French simply followed them through the open doors and forced an immediate surrender. They managed to capture the island without even having the French fleet available to them. St. Eustatius had gone from Dutch to British to French occupation all within a single year. But with the arrival of the French reinforcements under Admiral de Grasse, the French focused on some larger targets. They looked at the British-held Bahamas near the end of 1781, but they found the defenses there too strong. Instead, the fleet sailed north to St. Kitts, a larger island that was right by St. Eustatius. They almost immediately took the nearby island of Nevis, which they could use as a staging area. St. Kitts, though, had a much larger defense. Some estimates put about 12,000 British regulars and militia on the island. I suspect those British numbers are greatly inflated by expectations of local militia, who did not really materialize in the numbers expected. The French managed to land about 8,000 soldiers on St. Kitts on January 11, 1782. Admiral de Grasse provided naval support, while the Marquis de Boulay led the army. The French took the capital, Basseterre, without any resistance. The British soldiers retreated to a defensive position in the hills about 9 miles away. With the British behind fortifications on Brimstone Hill, the French settled in for a siege. Now, things looked bleak for the British defenders until another fleet entered the scene. The British Admiral Hood, who, after supporting the failed effort to relieve the British Army at Yorktown, had also sailed back to the West Indies. Hood's fleet of 21 ships of the line and 9 frigates arrived in Antigua on January 21st, where they took on supplies and about 1,000 soldiers. Hood then sailed his fleet to relieve the siege on St. Kitts. The British fleet arrived just off St. Kitts about 2 weeks after the siege had begun. Admiral Hood formed a line of battle and hoped to catch the French fleet under de Grasse off guard. The British managed to seize a couple of enemy frigates who were caught off guard by the newly arrived fleet, but the fighting with those frigates alerted the larger French fleet. The French fleet consisted of 29 ships of the line, which sailed out to do battle. De Grasse was also concerned that 4 additional French ships that were due to join the fleet would not be caught by the British before they could join with the rest. The two fleets moved away from the island, with some firing but not really a full engagement. One British frigate, the Solebay, was badly damaged. The captain drove the ship ashore on Nevis and removed the crew and set fire to it in order to deny it to the enemy. Rather than engage in an open-sea battle, Admiral Hood took his British fleet and simply sailed into the anchorage at St. Kitts that the French fleet had just left. While they were doing this, the French line attacked the British rear, threatening to sink the last 3 ships that were in the British line. 3 other British ships were able to turn and support their fellow ships that were at risk. They sailed directly for the French flagship, the Ville de Paris, and forced it to turn away. The French passed along the British line, exchanging broadsides, which ended up doing more damage to the French fleet than the British. By this time, it was evening, and the French withdrew. The British were in an awkward position. Hood's fleet was just offshore at St. Kitts. The ships had to remain far enough from shore to avoid the French shore batteries from the island. At the same time, they were aware that the French fleet would be back for another attack. The French Navy could not simply abandon the large French army that was on St. Kitts. As expected, the following morning, the French fleet under de Grasse brought its line against the British to exchange a brutal series of broadsides that greatly damaged both fleets. Witnesses claim that they began to lose sight of the nearby enemy due to all the smoke from near-continuous cannon fire. Badly damaged, the French fleet withdrew again. Casualties on both sides were pretty even, with a little over 300 killed or wounded on each side. So the British controlled the waters around St. Kitts, but the French army on the island continued its siege against the British garrison in the hills. On February 13th, about a month after the siege began, the British soldiers on the island surrendered. So at this point, the French controlled the entire island. The French Navy under de Grasse had received reinforcements and was ready to renew the battle with the British fleet. Admiral Hood had been expecting the arrival of reinforcements for his fleet with the 12 ships of the line under Admiral Rodney. But Rodney was still back at St. Eustatius looking for more treasure. So on the night of February 14th, the British fleet at St. Kitts quietly sailed away. They left lights on floating rafts to give the illusion that the fleet remained at anchor. So at dawn the following morning, the French looked to see that the British fleet had simply vanished. With French control of St. Kitts secured, the French fleet returned to their main base at Fort Royal on Martinique, while the British retreated to St. Lucia. Both fleets had to make considerable repairs before the next inevitable naval confrontation. By spring of 1782, the French fleet had consolidated at Martinique with 33 ships of the line. The British fleet under Admiral Rodney finally joined with the fleet under Admiral Hood, giving the British a total of 36 ships of the line. Since Rodney outranked Hood, he took command of the combined fleet. The French military coordinated with Francisco Saavedra de Sagrones, General Bureau for the Spanish Indies, and Bernardo de Galvez, the Spanish governor of Louisiana, Together, they developed a plan to take all the British islands in the West Indies. For the European powers, these islands were far more valuable than North America. The sugar plantations on these islands were the source of most colonial wealth. In early April, the Comte de Grasse sailed the French fleet out of Martinique, hoping to join with a Spanish invasion force of an additional 12 ships of the line. The Spanish had also assembled an army of 24,000 men who would combine with another 10,000 French soldiers who had arrived in the West Indies from France and another 5,000 French soldiers under de Grasse who had recently fought at Yorktown. This was a combined huge army and navy for the time, a total of 60 warships and about 40,000 soldiers. For French and Spanish military planners, the West Indies had become the priority of the war. More important than North America, more important than Gibraltar. Control of the West Indies would break Britain economically and greatly enrich France and Spain. When de Grasse left Martinique, he had a total of 150 ships in the fleet. Now, only 34 of these were ships of the line, and there were a few more smaller frigates, but most of the smaller vessels were slow-moving troop carriers that would only be a burden during a sea battle. De Grasse hoped to avoid a sea battle and bring the fight directly to Jamaica. At this point, Jamaica was one of the most valuable and largest colonies in the West Indies that was still under British control. Rodney received intelligence that the French fleet had left port, and he very much expected that Jamaica was their destination. He set sail with his own fleet, hoping to catch the enemy at sea before the French fleet could combine with the Spanish fleet. The British fleet divided into three commands. Admiral Rodney directly commanded one squadron, Admiral Hood commanded a second squadron, and Vice Admiral Samuel Francis Drake commanded a third squadron. Although the French fleet was larger, the British ships were faster and better equipped. The French fleet had left port on the morning of April 8th. British intelligence had been on top of French activities and were well aware of the movement. That same afternoon, Admiral Hood's squadron spotted the French fleet. Now, it was too late in the day and not enough wind for the fleets to engage then, but the battle would begin the following morning. Now, even after Admiral Rodney's squadron caught up with Admiral Hood, the French ships still outnumbered the total British by 2-1. The two fleets engaged on the morning of April 9th. Hood's squadron took considerable damage that day, but the fighting was inconclusive. Overnight, Drake's squadron arrived and took the position at the front of the British fleet, while Hood's damaged ships fell to the rear, where the men could work on repairs. Now, the French still hoped to avoid a major engagement at sea before giving the Spanish an opportunity to join them, so they simply sailed away. De Grasse continued on his original course after the engagement, separating the distance between the British fleet overnight. The British would have to pursue them. The French managed to keep a distance until the night of the 11th, when two of the French ships of the line collided with each other. One of the ships was very badly damaged and began drifting back toward the enemy fleet. Rodney, seeing an opportunity, sailed several of his ships at the two damaged ships. De Grasse had to turn his fleet around to protect them. During that night rescue, De Grasse's flagship, the Ville de Paris, also collided with one of the damaged ships, causing more damage to both ships. De Grasse tried to move his fleet toward Guadeloupe, while the British gave chase. The following day, April 12th, Drake's squadron moved into a line of battle to engage the French fleet. At that point, De Grasse had no choice but to engage. The two fleets exchanged broadsides. Right behind Drake's line was Rodney's squadron, which fired additional broadsides into the enemy fleet. The French line of ships faltered, leaving gaps between the ships. Rodney ordered the British to sail into those gaps, allowing the British to fire on the French from both sides of their ships at the same time, essentially doubling the amount of lead that they could throw at the enemy at once, and giving the enemy limited opportunity to fire back. Hood's squadron brought up the rear, inflicting even more damage on the French fleet. The slow-moving French ships began throwing their dead, and even some of their badly wounded, into the water to lighten their loads and speed up the ships. Sailors reported seeing large numbers of sharks gathering behind the ships to feast on the bodies. The British had the advantage and began to focus on several isolated French ships. A few of the French captains lowered their colors and surrendered. Admiral de Grasse, aboard the Ville de Paris, continued to fight even after his flagship was badly damaged and surrounded by the enemy. Many of the French ships which were able to do so sailed away, leaving their comrades aboard the damaged ships no choice but to surrender. At around 6 p.m., the Ville de Paris lowered her colors and Admiral Grasse surrendered. The next few days saw very little wind. The British fleet remained near Guadeloupe, trying to effect repairs on both its own ships and several captured prizes. After about a week, the wind returned. Admiral Hood took 10 ships in search of French stragglers. He came across 5 of them and managed to capture 4 of those. Admiral de Grasse survived the battle without being wounded, but all of the other officers and all but 3 sailors aboard the Ville de Paris were dead or wounded after the battle. On that one ship alone, the French suffered 400 killed and 700 wounded. There are wildly disparate estimates of the total French casualties among the entire fleet. These estimates range from 3,000 to 9,000 killed and wounded, including the deaths of 6 of the ship's captains. There were also between 5,000 and 6,000 soldiers and sailors captured. 9 French ships of the line were either captured or sunk. By contrast, the British lost about 1,000 casualties, about a quarter of whom were killed. The total British casualties across the entire fleet was less than the casualties of a single French ship, the Ville de Paris. Among the British casualties were 50 sailors who were aboard a French ship that had been captured but then blew up after its surrender. Admiral de Grasse became the first French admiral to be captured during a sea battle. Command of the remainder of the French fleet in the West Indies fell to another admiral, the Comte de Vaudreuil. He eventually joined up with the Spanish fleet, but the decimation of the French fleet and the loss of much of the Spanish army due to disease meant that they called off the planned invasion of Jamaica before they even got to the island. Admiral de Grasse, however, did reach Jamaica, but only as a British prisoner. Admiral Rodney returned to Jamaica with his fleet, along with prizes and prisoners. From Jamaica, a British ship of the line under Vice Admiral Peter Parker would carry de Grasse back to England. There, de Grasse would eventually be granted parole and return to France to face the consequences of his loss. Admiral Rodney would discover that officials in London had removed him from command because of accusations of his actions back at St. Eustatius. Admiral Hugh Pigott arrived in Jamaica to take command of the British fleet. Pigott had been kept out of the war because of political disputes with the North government, but by this time the Rockingham government had taken control of the government, and Pigott received this command. The British victory in this naval battle, which became known as the Battle of the Saints, which was a reference to all the nearby islands that were named after various saints, resulted in that the Spanish and French gave up on any major new offensives in the West Indies. Now, the Spanish fleet, as I said, never arrived to assist the French fleet at the Battle of the Saints. As that battle was coming to an end, the Spanish commander, Cagigil y Monserrate, left Havana aboard transport ships with 2,500 soldiers. Cagigil did not have his own ships. Instead, he hired American privateers to carry his army. He ignored orders to join the planned invasion of Jamaica and instead carried his army to the British-held Bahamas. On May 6th, his fleet arrived just off of Nassau. Cagigil managed to convince the British commander there, Vice Admiral John Maxwell, to surrender without firing a shot. Spain took the 600-man British garrison prisoner and captured a frigate, as well as a bunch of smaller ships, and 77 merchant ships. Despite the success, Galvez was upset that Cagigil had disobeyed orders and not joined the planned invasion of Jamaica. The attack on Jamaica had not happened anyway because of the defeat of the French fleet. Even so, Galvez had Cagigil arrested and imprisoned. Spain ended up giving Galvez credit for the capture of the Bahamas, even though Galvez had not approved the operation and in fact resisted it every step of the way. The Bahamas would remain under Spanish control as the war in the West Indies came to an end. Next week, we're going to head back to North America as British and American leaders tangle over the Huddy-Asgill affair. Hey, Thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show, part of the Airwave Media Network. Thanks to my Patreon supporters in the Alexander Hamilton Club, George Davis, Mike Hager, John Celentano, Michael Mulhern, and the Sons of the American Revolution. For those of you not familiar, the Sons of the American Revolution is an organization that promotes knowledge about the American Revolution and is open to any descendants of anyone who fought in the Revolutionary War. Thanks to our Robert Morris Circle supporters, Chasen Harrison and Joe Kelsey. Welcome also to Lori Magia, who joined us on Patreon last month at the Standard Bearer level. Like everyone who supports this podcast at the $10 level or higher on Patreon, Lori will receive a magnet each month with a different flag from the American Revolution. Anyone who supports me on Patreon at any level, as little as $2 a month, has access to commercial-free versions of each episode. I also appreciate one-time gifts via PayPal or Venmo. Either a one-time gift or an ongoing monthly subscription allows me to continue producing new episodes, and I greatly appreciate your support. Now, the overwhelming British victory that we went over today at the Battle of the Saints turned out to be pretty critical to Britain. It helped assure Britain that it would retain some island colonies in the West Indies, what we call the Caribbean today. The hero of that battle, Admiral Rodney, had been recalled to London to answer more questions about his efforts at personal enrichment. His efforts to strip St. Eustatius of anything of value, including property owned by British merchants, had turned many in London, and even a few naval officers, against him. Rodney had earlier faced some terrible interrogation in Parliament, mostly led by Edmund Burke, over this matter. Admiral Hood later referred to Rodney as a mere thief. Fortunately for Rodney, by the time he was relieved of his command, he had won that stunning victory at the Battle of the Saints. Although the new Rockingham government in London had replaced him before news of the victory arrived, he was hailed as a hero upon his return. The king granted him a peerage as Baron Rodney and granted him a generous pension of 2,000 guineas a year. Both houses of Parliament passed resolutions of thanks for his service in the West Indies, and they quietly ended the Committee of Inquiry into his actions at St. Eustatius. Despite all these laurels, it would, however, be the end of his naval career. The 64-year-old admiral never again returned to sea. He would live quietly in Plymouth and London until his death a decade later. Now, the battle would also result in the end of a naval career for French Admiral de Grasse. After being taken to England, de Grasse met with King George III and remained in London for a while, where he played a minor role in the peace negotiations that were under consideration at the time. Now, he would eventually be exchanged and returned to France in 1783. There, de Grasse faced heavy criticism for his losses at the Battle of the Saints. He demanded a court-martial and was acquitted in 1784. Even so, he never returned to sea and died about 4 years later. His role in the victory at Yorktown was something he regarded as rather a sideshow, yet it would be that victory for which de Grasse would be most remembered by history. The Battle of the Saints helped restore British domination of the seas. It ended the fighting in the West Indies. The British victory also meant that Americans could not count on the French Navy to return to assist them with future efforts to recapture British-held cities in America. The British victory also made ongoing peace negotiations much more difficult for the Americans. Part of the British victory was actually cut short by Mother Nature. That fall, Admiral Graves was leading much of the fleet that had been victorious at the Battle of the Saints back to Britain via Newfoundland. The fleet that was returning included the captured French ships, such as the Ville de Paris. The French prize ships and several of the British ships in that fleet sank when a hurricane swept over them. An estimated 3,500 men were killed by the storm, far more than the British battle losses in the West Indies and all of North America that year. Following the negotiations that ended the war, the Dutch would eventually regain control of St. Eustatius, although both French and British armies would retake the island in later wars over the next decade or two. St. Kitts would return to British control following the treaty negotiations that ended the war. British loyalists would recapture the Bahamas later in the war, but by the time they had actually captured it, Spain had already traded the Bahamas back to Britain as part of a land swap that gave Spain control of East Florida. As happened in all previous wars, the major European powers just cut deals based on what they had captured or protected to maximize their wealth and power until the next war started. My book recommendation this week is called Rodney and the Breaking of the Line by Peter True. It's a pretty short book and has some illustrations, so if you're looking for a real academic tone, this isn't it. But it covers the life of Admiral Rodney with an emphasis on the last 2 years leading up to and including the Battle of the Saints. The author, Peter True, is a former Member of Parliament. Now, this is one of the books that really gets at the topic of the Battle of the Saints. Most books don't really focus on the subject of this battle. So if you really want to learn more, get Rodney and the Breaking of the Line by Peter True. My online recommendation is called The Life and Correspondence of the Late Admiral Lord Rodney, Volume 2, edited by Godfrey Mundy. This book is mostly transcripts of Rodney's letters. It gives a good insight into the man and the events in which he participated. It's a great primary source. This book was released in book form in 1830 and, of course, in the public domain. As always, I've included direct links on my blog and website to go straight to the book on archive.org. My question this week asks, did Thomas Jefferson try to ban slavery in an early draft of the Declaration of Independence? Well, the Declaration of Independence was not law and really couldn't ban anything. It was simply declaring that the colonies considered themselves independent of Britain and the king. That could have really been done in one sentence. We hereby declare that we are independent of the king and Britain. But Jefferson sought to explain why they were declaring independence. As part of his explanation, Jefferson initially included an anti-slavery paragraph in his first draft, not to ban the practice of slavery, but to blame the king for its existence. And I'll read the quote to you. "He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian King of Great Britain. Determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold, he has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or restrain this execrable commerce, and that this assemblage of horrors might want no fact of distinguished dye. He is now exciting those very people to rise in arms among us and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them, and murdering the people upon whom he has also obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberties of one people with crimes which he urges them to commit against the lives of another." As you can see from that quote, Jefferson was not attempting to ban slavery. Rather, he was blaming the king for slavery in the British colonies. He was also accusing the king of trying to use the slaves against their masters, essentially playing the two sides off one another for his own benefit. In context, Jefferson argues that the king's behavior in these and other matters were part of the reason why the U.S. should be independent. Congress removed this passage from the final version for many reasons. First and foremost, the king really didn't impose slavery on the colonies. The colonies themselves engaged in the practice, and the king merely tolerated it. Most of the men who were going to be signing this declaration had engaged in the slave trade themselves or owned slaves. So it would be rather hypocritical to blame the king for tolerating what they themselves had been doing. Now, Jefferson's point was correct in that Virginia actually did try to stop the slave trade before the Revolutionary War, and the king's Privy Council prevented the colony from stopping it. But even when that happened, Virginia wasn't trying to abolish slavery. Slave owners in Virginia wanted to block new imports of slaves that would reduce the value of their domestic slave population. So this was more of a protectionist trade issue, nothing relating to the morality of slavery. Possibly Jefferson's goal in including this passage was to make the abolition of slavery part of the independence movement. By treating slavery as an act of tyranny, it would seem natural to want to end it. All of the 13 states declaring independence allowed slavery at the time. Their own colonial leaders had passed laws permitting and regulating the institution. By 1776, many Patriot leaders were becoming convinced that slavery was wrong and that it should end, but many others were not convinced yet and very much wanted to keep it. Slavery was what we would call today a wedge issue. It would have divided the leaders at a time when they needed to unite against the threat of continued British tyranny. Many states probably would not have signed the Declaration if ending slavery became a goal of the war. Some states probably would have rejected the independence movement entirely and sided with the British for the remainder of the war. As a result, the Congress believed that the Declaration was simply not the right time to address this issue, and that the matter should not be included in the document at all. If you have a question you'd like me to answer, please reach out to me, either via email or on Twitter, Facebook, Quora, or Reddit. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.